You're now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
Nick, I knew you from afar in New York, but you were a different person then.
It's not right.
Am I allowed to bring up the New York days?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So when I knew you from afar, you were a big Bitcoin guy. You wrote incredible essays. You still do. But in Miami, you're a new Nick, right? What's changed?
No, it's nothing's changed. Same guy.
Same Nick.
Same guy. I still like Bitcoin. Just the Bitcoiners don't like me. That's all.
Why don't they like you?
They're not very tolerant for, you know, dissenting views, the Bitcoiners.
Is there different maxi groups?
Yeah, I actually think there's been a ton of churn. I think most of the louder maxis are new, like 2021 and later. So I think it is actually a different set of people. Of course, there's some, you know, some of the old hands that were there from 2013 or before, but a lot of those people aren't as prominent in the conversation now. And so it really has taken on a different tenor, and I think it reflects just a newer crop of Bitcoiners, for better or for worse, mostly for the worse.
What happened to the old Bitcoin maxis, the old guard? Where'd they go? They just make too much money and leave, or did they?
Yeah, some of them just retired from being involved in any capacity. I mean, some of them just became more pluralistic. You know, they recognize that there's other stuff going on. And it's not just about Bitcoin. Bitcoin's not the be-all, end-all. I think that happened to a lot of people.
They move quietly, though.
Yeah, because you don't announce it.
Yeah.
And I mean, just the facts on the ground change. Like early on, Bitcoin was the whole crypto industry, and then now it's not. Yeah. And if you're interested in innovation and like L2s, for instance, like where is all the L2 development happening? It's for the most part not on Bitcoin. So like, if you're interested in the fundamentals here, there's other fundamentals besides Bitcoin. And I think most Bitcoins are moderates. It just doesn't seem that way from the public conversation.
So it seems to me, and I got started later than you, I'm like a 2017, 2018 crypto guy, which I still think is somewhat seasoned, but not as much as you. But when I got into crypto, it seemed like, or from when I got in until now, it seemed like the Bitcoin crew created kind of like a cult. Like they figured out that there wasn't that much they can do on the L2 or the tech side or the app side. So the conversations devolved into like cult-like aggression, where everything was based around like philosophy and just boxing out every other L1. It seems like that's only gotten more toxic. But again, now shifting back, it seems like a lot of that's kind of fallen to the wayside, right? Like it's not as prominent anymore. I guess, is that the right like view of it, or how do you view that community?
Yeah, I mean, I think the more fundamentalist elements of Bitcoin are just a secular religion. Like, there are many such things in this world. There's a lot of secular religion. So when you strip away real religion, it's not that people become total atheists. They just find other religious movements to join, which aren't literally churches, but they're still religious, right? Veganism, Soul Cycle, CrossFit.
No seed oils.
The seed oil disrespect, maybe we're getting there. Other things, like being a climate advocate, someone that shuts down highways because they're scared about the climate. Like arguably all these things are secular religions. They're things that people use to fill the God-shaped hole in their lives. And Bitcoin is no different. Of course, Bitcoin is just literally a tool. It's a technology, but for a certain contingent, they elevate it far beyond that. And it's a lifestyle. It's a set of norms. There's purity tests. There's things you have to believe. It offers salvation, damnation, and that's the status quo. So you can call them whatever you want. You can call them maxis, or you could call them what they are, which is basically fundamentalists.
What's the deepest you've ever been in the Bitcoin hive mind thought process? Like, you ever find yourself at like some cult meeting one time, or what's the deepest you've gone?
I mean, the Bitcoin prayer breakfasts that Jimmy Song used to put on at during conferences. I mean, frankly, I find it sacrilegious because, like, the Bible doesn't really say a lot about money. I mean, it certainly doesn't encourage you to pursue money or make money your sole objective. Quite the contrary. I mean, you know, there's a couple things here and there about usury, but Christianity doesn't intersect very much with you know, pecuniary concerns. And so I think focusing this much on Bitcoin from a Christian perspective feels like idolatry to me. And it doesn't actually feel like it fits with any version of the church that I'm familiar with. So yeah, I'm pretty against that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it seems a little crazy. I know we're going out of order here. We're starting with you and Bitcoin, but let's continue.
Bitcoin Civil War.
Let's
it's been new developments.
it is. I mean, we'll go to choke point after, but so I guess let's fast forward now. So it's now not like hearsay or like you don't get canceled for saying that Bitcoin may have issues in the future based on its cap, based on its security budget, based on its spend. Years ago, you'd get, dragged out and killed and tortured. I guess what's your view on that, being so knowledgeable and involved from such an early stage until now? Like, are you willing to put a large percent of your net worth in Bitcoin with its uncertain future on that? Or am I like completely wrong here?
Yeah, I would say a decent percentage of my net worth is in Bitcoin. So, my money's where my mouth is, I guess. But you'd also let's say you own a lot of Apple stock. That doesn't mean you think Apple's unimpeachable or nothing bad can ever happen, right? Bitcoin, I think it's important that we recognize that the security budget matters and that we start to think constructively about it. If we didn't have that conversation at all, I would be a lot more concerned. At least there's moderate factions where the mere discussion of that isn't completely haram, right?
Not so anymore.
At least now we're allowed to talk about it. Are there solutions? TBD. The good news is that we're going to have a long lead time. The halvings are pretty slow and the security budget's pretty high right now. And mining is actually getting pretty distributed as far as I can tell. I mean, there's trends in both directions there, but the notion of hobbyist miners, I think, is a good thing, or small scale miners. And the lessening of monopolies where, before it really mattered if you had a really tight relationship with Bitmain, I think it doesn't matter as much now. Things like that. And the decline in the curve for development in terms of ASIC chips and things like that. But the fees are pretty low. Like, the non-subsidy based reward is low. That's a fact. If the subsidy went away, then we would have a problem, I think. So I'm excited by new trends where people are looking at, potential pressures to create higher fees structurally, ordinals of being one of them. But there's a lot of work to do. So there's no immediate crisis. But I think it's something to think about and have an active discussion on.
I guess one thing that's good about the cult vibes slowly fading is that the communities would be more open to the changes, whether that be, obviously removing the hard cap is probably the last thing they do, but maybe moving to proof of stake or something like that would be way easier with, I guess, the real vocal critics fading into other L1s. Or how do you feel about that?
I don't think Bitcoin will ever explicitly move to proof of stake. I could see it moving to de facto proof of stake.
What's the difference?
Backdoored proof of stake. So it's not like the code, out there on Bitcoin Core, it says in the code, hey, we're now a proof of stake protocol. It would be a backdoor proof of stake. So
seems ominous. What does that mean?
It's actually an okay outcome, I think. So there would still be mining. It's just that the mining wouldn't be done by purely economically interested entities. It would be done by the largest custodians and exchanges and service providers in Bitcoin on a somewhat altruistic basis. Not altruistic in the sense of saving the world, but because their business has a significant dependency on Bitcoin, they then vertically integrate and get into the protocol side, into the infrastructure side as well.
They would still be mining, though.
They'd be mining, but it would be effectively proof of stake, because it'd be the largest holders of Bitcoin would be mining somewhat proportionally to their exposure to Bitcoin, if that makes sense.
Got it. Okay.
And they may be even losing money on the mining part, but it'd be worth it because they have protocol proximity for MEV purposes, to give their clients priority access to the blockchain, things like that.
would that be more or less centralized than it is today, do you think?
Probably more, because like mining right now is actually pretty nicely distributed, I would say. And it's easier to have more concentration in terms of the big, large exchanges and service providers because there's regulatory moats.
That'd be interesting.
So
it'd be like a Coinbase or Anchorage or...
So, I mean, that's how proof of stake is going now, arguably. I mean, TBD, you see what happens with the SEC and if they ban, you know, custodial proof of stake or anything like that. But that's kind of, if you look at the big stakers, they tend to be big service providers, exchanges, entities that have a lot of coins in the first place. So yeah, I think it would basically be in the same direction.
It's pretty interesting. That's cool.
So I'm not saying this is what should happen. I'm not like trying to make this future reality. But if mining revenues fall over time, it could be that they take it upon themselves to them be the stewards of the protocol and keep revenue, mining revenue at a certain level, keep a certain amount of hash rate up, basically.
Makes sense.
Absent like the normal market forces.
Yeah, I get it. So, I mean, we're relatively young. I think the subsidy ends in 2140.
Yeah, but like, you know, de facto it ends much earlier than that.
Exactly. Right? So
that was always such a stupid argument that like we're not going to have to worry about it until 2140. It's like, guys, there's another halving like next year.
You worry about global warming when the
yeah, like Caesar rises? There's like a degree of gradualism here, yeah. Please. Yeah,
like, we can't deal with global warming when we see the tornadoes.
There's intermediate states.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. So you're going to be alive when this comes to a head. Like you're going to have to make an action decision.
Honestly, I hope so. Unless I crash my Vespa. You
can't
know,
crash that thing.
It doesn't go fast enough. Yeah.
Somebody could crash into you.
almost did on the way here.
That's the bad part. Okay. So there'll be a point in your life, and this is many decades out and many like technological changes.
Could be like one decade out, to be honest.
Let's talk a decade out. Like what would lead you to move out of Bitcoin? Like what developments would you look for? And when I ask move out, I mean sell 100%. Oh. So I'm talking like binary decisions here.
Put me on the spot.
On the spot. Like what is the lack of progress that would make you completely exit? Or I'm trying to think of like the trigger for you to get fed up and just move on.
Well, see, you know, if there was a thing that could make me leave Bitcoin, I would have already left Bitcoin because turns out the Bitcoiners pretty much don't like me. So I already dealt with that and I'm still here. So, you know, that really speaks volumes, I think. But I would say there's an early quote from a certain Mr. Satoshi, which was in 20 years, Bitcoins have very high volume or very low volume. So it would be a, you know, total failure or a success, in which case maybe we don't have to worry about fees because there'll be a lot of fees from lots of volume. That would be my yardstick. Are people actually using it as a settlement network? 20 years from when he said that is only 6 years from now. So if Bitcoin after 20 years hasn't succeeded as a settlement network, I think it's safe to say it's never going to. So that's not that far away. So if I'm not seeing progress towards transactions, settlements, fees, and that's the essence of the security budget, after 20 years, I think that's enough time to call the experiment a failure.
So I got to have you back on in 6 years.
Yeah. Let's set the calendar and invite.
We'll throw the clips up.
Look what you said. I think Bitcoin is great and I do think it's likely to succeed, but, you know, don't know the precise form. But I think also it's fair to be data driven in these things. Like you can look at the actual volume, how much wealth is it storing? Are people using it? Is there demonstrated utility? You know, let's be data driven about these things.
I don't know the right word for it, but it does feel like a slow quit for most people. Like it just feels like people tend to fade out because on one side it's like structural issues they have to fix and it's hard. And on the other side, it's like, there's just so much cool stuff going on in other ecosystems. So when you're like a normal person just deciding between those two camps, I feel like over the course of the next, call it 6 years, people are going to opt for interesting over issues. But
and you have to be really heroic to try and develop in the Bitcoin ecosystem.
It's a huge reward, though.
I mean, to try and push any change at the protocol level is you know, really hard. So I see, and I talk to founders that are building L2s on Bitcoin, things like that. To the extent it requires a change to the protocol, that's very difficult, of course.
No, it is.
But there's only a few more opcodes that would unlock a ton of value in Bitcoin if they were to be passed.
Is it as simple as the social consensus to get them clicked on, or what's the...
Yeah, it's just an acknowledgement that maybe an opcode that allows ZK rollups to exist on Bitcoin, that would unlock a tremendous amount of value. I don't think that's too far-fetched. I mean, we had Taproot, and nobody even knew what Taproot was for when it came in. It
took a long time.
People now figured out how to use it, which is ironically to put images on the blockchain. So that's the first use case for Taproot.
It's not what I expected.
I mean, I get that it's a slow process. It was literally 5 years between protocol upgrades. But there's just a tiny number of things that unlock immense value. So. Yeah.
So I invited you on the podcast to talk about your life and everything. But the core thesis and the big idea was Operation Choke Point. So you wrote a paper, was it 2 weeks ago?
So yeah, something like that.
Around 2 weeks ago? You wrote a paper 2 weeks ago called Operation Choke Point, and the thesis or the preface was that the government agencies are cutting off crypto's access to the banking sector, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I read it a few times. What was the genesis for that post? Like, you list out like a couple of events, but you bulleted out a lot of different events and examples of why crypto's entities are getting cut off from the banking system, which is obviously massive important for us. But what led you to say, you know, hey, it's not a coincidence, this is a full-scale operation?
Yeah, the specific thing would have been the January 27th events, where a lot of things happened on the same day, within hours of each other. The custodia denial, the Fed coming out with a statement on their policy with regards to state-chartered banks, the National Economic Council, which is basically the economic arm of the White House, came out with a statement at that point. Those things happening at the same time obviously implies a coordination. It's not a coincidence that those things happen at the same time. Adding up the pattern of evidence where we see cross-agency coordination, all with the same objective, the same stated goal, the same language, is to ring-fence the crypto industry, wall it off from the bank sector, stop any quote-unquote systemic risks spilling over from the crypto space into the bank sector. It's all being done at the same time, same language, and all these agencies are working together on it. Since I wrote the article, I now have confirmation that it is coordinated. So people, former regulators, reached out to me. They're like, yes, what you're saying is consistent with my understanding. I have members of Congress taking up the cause. Several senators. The Fed came out with a statement today denying it, which means that it's real.
So you know, the Fed came out and said that
we're not, they didn't say choke point, but they said we're not systemically stopping banks from touching crypto.
Why would they ever feel the need to release a report or a statement on something that's a blog post? I'm not denouncing your work.
Well, yeah, I mean, they didn't mention the blog post by name, but it was clear. I mean, this... Not to toot my own horn, but this thing was repeated. The point that I made was repeated in every single major financial outlet subsequent to me writing it.
So you said former regulators agreed with your take. That means regulators have been like out of the game, which means that they knew back when they were in a job that this was going to happen.
But they know basically how Washington works.
Okay.
And I don't think it's a secret, honestly. Like, the Biden admin has an explicit agenda on crypto. So this is just the regulators carrying out the agenda.
How do you think they determined, like how do you think they determined the trade-off between, like, something like stifling innovation, cutting off crypto to the banking sector, and making the U.S. the hub for the future of technology, right? Because by cutting off access, they're completely stifling the future of U.S. tech.
I think they view crypto as more of a vector for scams than a potential groundswell of innovation, to be honest with you. Crypto is not their top priority. It's like their 10th priority. Yeah. So they don't devote that much thought to it, to be honest. They had all of their executive orders and things like that. But With regards to tech, their main priority is like reshoring the chips industry, the industrial policy, I think it's called.
So what you're saying is like it's just a culmination of like lazy old thinking across all government agencies to cut off crypto.
Well, I think generally progressives, I'm not saying the Biden admin is that progressive, but generally they prefer for financial transactions to happen within the regulated aegis so that they can use finance to promote policy objectives. I mean, we know this, like the SEC, what's their number one agenda item is climate. It's not crypto.
The SEC?
Yeah. It's but not
capital formation. And
well, yeah, you might think that, but the Gensler SEC, their number one objective is actually climate. It's making public firms do climate disclosures. So that's just an example. Generally speaking, there is a view that finance ought to be used to promote policy objectives, which was what Choke Point was all about. That's what Choke Point 2.0 is all about. Financial flows are a way to create political change. That's what happened with the sanctions with Russia, right? The objective is we have control over the hub of finance. Let's use it. You know, let's use it to potentially end the war in Ukraine, et cetera. Let's use it to have public companies do climate disclosures. Let's use it for, you know, racial equity or whatever. Like there's an abundance of agendas you can impose via finance. And I think they just don't see a lot of value in crypto, to be honest with you. I mean, I've had conversations with White House staffers. I gave a talk there on, they asked me to come and talk about mining. Then they wrote a report on mining that was the harshest thing I've ever read in my life.
You didn't do a good job on your talk, man.
After that, I was like, I'm never talking to these guys ever again. They didn't listen at all.
All right, I'll play devil's advocate. So it seems like it's really easy to influence, and everyone in the government, I'm sure, is doing the best they can, right? But it seems really easy to influence people that don't have a lot of knowledge on something, a lot of groupthink. Do you think that that could work in the reverse? Like, do you ever think that they'll see Hong Kong, other countries fully embracing crypto, crushing it, and then the tune changes and it reverts faster than we think, right? Like the rubber band gets pulled back too far and these guys all start saying, Nick, come talk to us.
Well, I think that will happen, but it'll take an administration change. So
does it matter what party?
Probably. People try and keep crypto nonpartisan, but
it's partisan.
There's a clear revealed preference for crypto among the two parties. It's just a fact. I'm not the one trying to make that claim. That's just obvious. So yeah, I think it's certainly a partisan issue. If you get President AOC, I can assure you, I'm not actually sure she can run in the next election. She might be too young.
So if we get a Republican president, that would be bullish.
I think so. I think so. And look, Trump wasn't exactly a crypto fan. And in his admin, he had crypto haters. Like Mnuchin didn't like crypto at all. Yeah. But at the same time, we had the OCC chair, whose name escapes me right now, who's incredibly pro-crypto. If you looked at DeSantis, for instance, much more explicitly pro-crypto. I don't know if he'll make it. At all.
Not sure if he's running, is he?
I can't predict the election. But yeah, I think if it was a Republican president, it'd be very different. And that seems to be the attitude of a lot of folks in the industry, is literally just wait it out for the next 2 years.
I have you here for accurate predictions, all right?
Okay. All right, let me get on my Nate Silver.
So I guess the other side of this is like looking through what else that they can do, what else the government can do to cut off crypto, right? So they've done this whole list of events. They clearly have this agenda. What do you think is the single like kill shot they can do to like have maximum impact on crypto?
Go to Coinbase and tell them to delist everything.
Damn.
Yeah. I mean, I think the SEC, I don't know why the SEC hasn't tried to use the exchanges as these specific nexuses.
Yeah.
Because the SEC right now is going piecemeal through a bunch of tokens, some completely random ones, to be honest with you. That's not a very high leverage strategy. Like that's years of litigation. Look at the Ripple case.
Hester Peirce made me laugh. I think she said like if the SEC continues their strategy, they'll be done with enforcing in like 400 years or
something. Yeah, exactly. Like, if this can't be a strategy that they cooked up from the top, and like, it's, it must be kind of ad hoc. It must be like, oh, staffer here, one of our staffers came up with this token, let's go after them, whatever. Like, I refuse to believe there's a grand plan. It doesn't make sense. If you wanted to really end the like token industry, you're Gary Gensler, you wanted to end it, of course you go to the exchanges and you say, we need you to develop a Howie opinion on all of these 500 tokens or whatever.
I mean, killing USDC was always my thought.
Like, but they, I just don't see how they could. I mean, they are attacking BUSD. I think, frankly, BUSD may have strayed outside their mandate with what they agreed with DFS, as far as I can tell. But I don't see them going after USDC. I think that would be very difficult. I mean, Circle, Center, they're fulfilling their obligations, right? They KYC folks that are creating, redeeming the stable coins. I'm sure they're undertaking some level of surveillance in terms of the on-chain transactions.
Yeah.
It's a U.S. entity. They are regulated to the maximum extent they can be. I don't see what they might be doing that would be stepping outside of those boundaries.
So now we're at a point where...
Certainly not a security, let me tell you that.
Yeah.
The fiat-backed stablecoins, there is no world in which they're securities. I don't care if you know, it's like, okay, well, there's Howie and there's Reeves. If you look at the case law around Reeves, if you read the cases, I don't know why I did this, but I went and I read the case. The Reeves case looks nothing like a stablecoin. It was an interest-bearing loan. So all of the other cases historically where Reeves has been applied, those are loans. Those are like fixed income.
USDC is not a loan.
No. And the only exception there is probably UST, Terra, where the SEC is alleging it was a security under Reeves. But they probably have a case there because people bought UST to put it in Anchor, or it was redeemable for Luna, if I'm remembering correctly. So it wasn't really something that people were buying in order to, you know, make transactions necessarily. Whereas this normal stable coins, people aren't just doing those for like mere speculative purposes. They're using them for general cash management, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a huge disanalogy, I would say.
That's the clearest example of why a stable coin is not under Reeves that I've heard.
I mean, it's a 4-point test, actually. So not
the same as Howie's 4 points.
Howie's four. It's different 4 points, okay. Though. So let me see if I can remember it.
If these 4 points don't work, we'll try the next four.
So it's like are there promotional efforts of the issuer? Do people think of it as an investment? Is it treated like an investment? That's one of the points. Clearly not the case for USDC. Are people using it solely to facilitate speculation or investment? That's one of the points. And yeah, a lot of it pertains to the way it's marketed. Like if the issuers are saying you can buy this note and make money on it, like then that makes it more likely to be considered a security. As far as I'm concerned, fiat-backed stablecoins don't pass that test at all.
So it kind of makes sense why the SEC hasn't gone after USDC. Because to your points, it would be a much harder case. And especially with all the examples they have that are easier cases.
They would lose that case. It might go to the Supreme Court, but they would lose it.
Takes me to my next question.
Okay.
So I asked our lawyers internally. We have a great group of lawyers. And I was playing a bit of devil's advocate. They probably wanted to shoot me. But I said, hey, you know, there's so many, there's so much litigation and regulatory fights going on right now. The SEC to Ripple to... just there's going to be a lot of courtroom drama, right? But I asked them, I said, it's the first time the SEC really has to go into court to prove their case and potentially lose a couple cases. Is there any way that you see them overextending, potentially losing a couple of cases? I know the types of cases are broad, but just generally, and that like driving precedent to help crypto.
My mental model, I know we're not allowed to talk about mental models anymore. Like, that's not cool anymore, I think.
Get canceled.
VCs said, they said mental model too many times over the last, on podcasts, is like a cheetah on the savannah for the SEC. This is my mental model. So you're a cheetah. You're trying to decide what antelope to kill. You only have so many reserves. You only have so much glycogen in your muscles. You can only do your little sprint, like, I don't know, 8 times a day max. You only have so much energy. And so you probably go after the weakest gazelles, right? I mean, and if you go after one, you lose, like, all your cheetah buddies are going to make fun of you, you know? Like, it's just embarrassing. So what is the strongest gazelle out there right now in the savannah?
God.
It's Ripple. It's Ripple. Ripple has the resources to fight the SEC. They could win that case.
I never thought I'd be pro Ripple.
I same here.
Man, I went on Bloomberg calling it a scam.
And yeah, look, I'm not a Ripple fan, but I think they could win the case. This is not investment advice for God's sakes.
I mean, I doubt they'd fully win, right?
You're right,
like, but probably a gray area.
Yeah, but you know, think about it. They inherited that case from Jay Clinton, the SEC. That wasn't Gensler's own doing. That was the prior one.
Got it.
I'm sure they wouldn't have even tried to do it if, you know, because they want to go after the weak and the old and the sick gazelles, you know?
Well, the problem with the, and I like your analogy, but the problem is, like, if the cheetah wins, every antelope is also dead. Like, but like that, like, because you get case law, you get precedent.
Yeah, it certainly gets easier. I do think the courts will be sympathetic to the SEC's point of view on a lot of this stuff, especially the more scammy, you know, Kim Kardashian tokens, okay, whatever.
Yeah, no.
Frankly, even on the Kraken staking, I think they have a point, dare I say, not on staking generally, but the way that one was configured.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not just here to blanket allege that everything the SEC says is true is false. That's not the case. Like, sometimes I think their analysis is correct.
Yeah.
But other times it's just, like, wildly off base.
That is pretty interesting. So, it doesn't sound like you're as... So... I guess, like, what I'm gleaning from you is you lean bearish on, like, the politicians and elected representatives we have in the government, but you sound slightly positive on the fact that crypto may be able to defend itself in the judicial branch. So I guess you're like bearish legislative, slightly positive judicial.
Oh, well, I like that. This is taking me back to AP government. All right. So max bearish executive. Which is where all the regulators
Unless
are.
Unless we get a new president. That's Republican.
Yeah, for the next 2 years, max bearish. Legislative, slightly positive, because the House...
That's contrarian.
We have so many allies in the House. In the Senate, it's very mixed. In the House, McHenry, chair of the Financial Services Committee, took over from Maxine Waters. Of course, Tom Emmer, everyone's favorite representative.
Love him.
Third most powerful member of the House right now. He's the whip. What the whip does, I don't know. I like that he's called the whip. I think of it very literally. I hope that he has an actual whip. I think that he whips the other members of his party into shape.
Love crypto.
But here's the real power that the House has. They can subpoena people. You gain subpoena authority when, so like the Democrats had it before in the House, now the Republicans have it because they're the majority party. They can just harass people. For lack of a better word. So it's not like they now can't pass legislation because they don't agree with the Senate. Nothing's going to get passed. I don't think we're going to get any crypto legislation one way or another. But they can launch investigations. That's how Choke Point ended the first time. There's a representative, I think, Lutkemeyer, I believe Missouri, if I'm not misremembering, asked the FDIC, what the hell's going on here? Are you giving off-the-books guidance to banks to not touch all these industries? Brought into the open. That we could see the same thing here. We already have members of Congress asking about it. We could ask Gensler hard questions about his relationship with FTX and IEX. What went on there? Why was he so close to this organization but didn't spot anything? That's one of the tools of defense here.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. If the House sees that basically bank regulators are systemically attacking a perfectly legal industry, an American industry, which is, you know, thriving, and America is the nexus of the crypto space, they might ask those questions.
So if the House launches investigations and they find out that government officials were giving, like, off the books, hostile advice to not back crypto, not support, et cetera, does that just mean that those people giving the advice are pulled back? Or, like, it wouldn't be like pro crypto, it would just stop the people that are holding it back? I'm trying to understand, like, what comes of the investigations.
Well, it's basically a power struggle. So the reason the regulators are getting so aggressive now is because they see that Congress isn't going to do anything, positive or negative. So they see Congress as being stymied. Remember, we're entering the lame duck part of Biden's session here. I mean, you know, pending re-election. So nothing's going to happen on the legislative side. The regulators now taking it upon themselves to get active and like do something about crypto. Basically, the FTX collapse and all the other things that happened last year, that gives them a lot of political clout to do that. But the House or the Senate could rightfully say, hey, you guys are actually overstepping your authority here. Your job as a regulator is to enforce the law. It's not to create new laws. We create laws. What are you doing? Stop doing that.
What would it take for Emmer to launch that investigation with the SEC?
He said that he would look into them. But I mean, he's openly said it.
Does he have the power? Can he just wake up one morning and say, launch an investigation? Here we go.
I'm not sure. I will send him an email.
Thank you. I've been trying to get him on here.
But he did my show twice.
Damn.
Not to flex or anything.
No, that's a good flex.
I'll suggest.
No, I'll link to it. That's pretty cool.
He literally said it on my show, though. So
does he understand crypto to a deep level, do you think?
Yes. That's nice. More so than any other person in Washington I've interacted with.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, I'm impressed. It's, you know, I don't think his constituents are like begging him to do stuff about crypto.
What state is he from?
Minnesota. So I think he just really believes in property rights and, you know, new technology.
It's pretty cool.
So it's cool that he took up the mantle. It must be very unrewarding, to be honest.
I really hope Hester Peirce stays on for, I'm not sure when her term ends, but or what the process is for her to stay on. But I'm hoping that she doesn't go into the private sector and stays as our champion.
Yeah, I mean, it's very impressive to see her have a principled stance time and again when the rest of her colleagues are doing things she clearly disagrees with.
Yeah.
I don't know how it works, though. I guess, is it maybe 5-year terms?
So to circle back, where you're a pretty bearish executive, at least for the next 2 years, potentially Republican president changes that. Legislative, I think what you're sharing is, I think you're sharing context that it's a little bit more bullish than people think.
They just have tools that they could use to address the executive overreach, but what they're not going to do, as far as I can tell, is actually pass any legislation.
Okay. And then the judicial side seems like an absolute mixed bag to me.
The courts are, I think, our best hope. But the problem is that they grind so slow. I mean, it's very, very slow.
Yeah, but it just...
But the courts, they ultimately are the arbiter of like truth and reality. And that's on our side most of the time.
How do you expect a judge, though... And I'm extremely smart people, and I have to deal with this with every single case. But I mean, how do you expect judges in aggregate to be pro crypto when it's such a new, here we go, mental model to understand, right? Like for them to understand what crypto is, to rule in a positive way, like that's tough.
But I think if you look at the substance of the matter, just because it's a new technological backdrop, it doesn't mean that they haven't seen these problems before. So
it's true.
Determining whether something is a security or not, that's kind of irrelevant. The like at precise technological implementation. Same with a stable coin. You know, those have existed in other contexts. And, you know, I'm not sure we're doing anything sufficiently novel that it's like impossible for a court to understand.
How do you feel about, switching gears here a bit, how do you feel about Binance and the U.S. going after them? Because when you bring up choke point, and we talk about companies like Circle and Coinbase and Silvergate and Kraken, I'm just always astounded that the focus isn't on Binance instead.
It's remarkable. And, you know, in prior eras, it would have been impossible for Binance to do what they did, which was build a huge business without any real support from, you know, no real banking access, at least initially. You just wouldn't have been able to do that. So the fact that we have public blockchains is what enabled them to be so big. So they, from birth, didn't have that dependency. I mean, stablecoins are enough for them. That's why stablecoins came to exist, because Bitfinex had difficulty settling up with their clients. That's why they created Tether. So they have this like Teflon nature to them, because the primary tool that the U.S. government would use to go after them, which is banks, that's not as, you know, that doesn't really affect them as much.
Wait, you said Bitfinex created Tether so that they could more easily deal with their clients? I didn't know that.
That's my understanding. That's kind of the motive for it existing. Like,
that's pretty cool.
The whole point of stablecoins was to escape this systematic censorship of the crypto industry that happened through banks.
Do you think Binance has gotten so big and they just have so much money and they have, I'm not a Binance expert, but they have like gleams of regulatory stance with creating Binance US and having Binance. Like, do you think that eventually they'll get away scot-free? And when I say scot-free, I say Mormon style settlement where they pay $1 million on billions in capital.
Yeah, that was just recent, right?
The, I think that was yesterday, the day before.
It's like a single digit million.
$32 billion in AUM, I think.
Yeah, enormous.
Why not do that? Like, why not?
What are they planning on? How did they invest it? That's what I want to know.
I don't know.
Who's the CIO over there? I need to meet this person.
I've never done a deal with the Mormon
Do they
Church.
Invest in venture funds? Do you have to be a Latter-day Saint to get investment from them? I'll convert.
Yeah, me too.
It depends on the check size.
You can get really good terms.
So, yes, I think Binance is now big enough that they're able to strike up relationships with governments globally and get enough protection from some government or other. I think there'll always be one.
Yeah.
And they're less dependent on the US. So
it's not necessarily a bad thing, right? I mean,
I don't believe that they're like a malevolent force. I mean, actually, I do use Binance US. It's pretty good.
But I've honestly never had a problem with CZ.
So I think some people, Bitcoiners, don't like them because they think that they, you know, are the biggest crypto casino, which is true, but they see them as very mercenary and, you know, helping for, you know, causing noobs or whatever to lose money. But what Bitcoiners don't get is that Binance is also just they're a bank that like over 100 million people use worldwide to get access to either Bitcoin or stable coins. You know, they're just treated like a fintech app by a lot of people.
The crazy part too is that like their less well-capitalized counterpart, Coinbase, is the one that will have to lead the regulatory charge. I mean, it seems like Binance could kind of stay in the back seat, let Brian Armstrong go to Washington and see how it pans out.
But I'm sure Brian Armstrong is not saying nice things about Binance when he goes to Washington. So
that's true.
So if they get a regulatory moat, which they already almost have, in my opinion, that'll come at the expense of Binance's ability to do business in the US.
I love Coinbase. I'm just waiting for a PE firm to go and clean house.
I'm surprised it hasn't happened already.
It just seems like if they stuck to being a regulatory compliant exchange without all the hundreds of millions of dollars spent on NFT marketplaces and massive staff, they'd be valued a lot higher.
Yeah. I mean, the financials that came out recently were pretty bleak.
They're rough.
To be honest with you.
Well, they launched a new chain to cover it up.
I found it kind of interesting.
Me too. It's good timing.
Yeah, sentiment was pretty high around that.
It was. So long term, you think Binance is okay?
I don't think anyone's ever too big to fail. And there's probably ways. Let's say the US government, like the DOJ or NYAG, like really wanted to take them down. There's probably things they could do to really mess with them.
My view is that if they want to take you down, they'll always find something.
I believe so.
You've done.
I believe so. It doesn't matter if you're based in the Seychelles and you've never even heard of America, you know, like, you know, let alone have any American clients. They'll find a way to get you somewhere along the line. Someone touched a dollar and that is all they need.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I am slightly bullish, copish on the amount of US people that have stayed here to build despite pretty rough regulatory space.
I agree. Frankly, it's very hard to re-domicile yourself.
That's true.
I mean, Miami's a good place to do it because you can just whip across to the Bahamas. But like if you're a US citizen, like foreign banks aren't going to want to serve you anyway.
Yeah.
That's the truth of it. Cause then they're risking American regulators coming in and messing with them.
Yeah.
So like there are regulatory hotspots that are absolutely opening up. Abu Dhabi, Hong Kong, maybe to a certain degree, Switzerland, Luxembourg. So there's places where people are going. But if you're an American, I would say you don't really have a choice. Like, you're kind of stuck here. And I respect the spirit of American crypto entrepreneurs that are sticking around, and they will fight. It's like, you have the choice of voice or exit. Nobody really goes for exit. It's just
so
voice.
Boring.
And you don't want to become an exile in your 20s.
No.
Like the Puerto Rico thing, that's fine. Don't go into exile. Things can change.
Why didn't you do PR?
I've actually spent enough time in PR to tell you that I don't want to live there. I love Puerto Rico for sure.
But I like being a host, so I don't get asked these questions.
I would never live there.
Yeah. No, I mean, you gotta like where you live, that's for sure.
Or, yeah, I mean, look, Miami's got all the good stuff about PR without any of the bad stuff. So
yeah, I do like Miami. So I guess, like, rounding out the conversation on Choke Point, you have a lot of knowledge on where we're going, where the government's going. You're a VC with Third Fund, right? With your third fund. You talk to founders all day long, and they're probably all asking you the same question. Like, Nick, you know, the government is, we're unsure what they're going to do. We're not sure what we can do. We don't know if we can apply for no action letters or if we should launch tokens or whatever. What is your advice to them?
If you need permission from the SEC or some other agency to do your business, that's going to be very hard. If it's just a matter of asking, are we going to be able to get a bank relationship? Raise more capital is what I would say. Get those institutional markers on your cap table, those markers of legitimacy, and you will still be able to get that bank relationship. It's just much harder now. And be ready for the pass-through level of diligence to be insane. Because what the FDIC is saying to every bank is, oh, yeah, you can touch crypto clients. It's not prohibited, but we're going to bury you in a mountain of paperwork if you do it. So, yeah, no, by all means, go ahead. Go ahead. See what happens.
Yeah. There's not many crypto banks out there, right? There's Signature, there's Silver Bank.
Yeah.
Disclosure, I own some Silver Bank stock, but like.
And Silvergate's recommitted to the crypto space impressively. Signature has curtailed the size of their crypto business a lot.
I don't think Silvergate was malicious in any of the FTX stuff. But I think that
we'll see what comes out. I know there's a couple of cases going on. I agree. I mean, I think they could have been duped by SBF and Alameda just as everybody else was.
It was a $40 million bank in the middle of nowhere before crypto. I mean, they were, and most like family employees, like, it blew up given crypto.
Yeah. I mean, and they've added a tremendous amount of value to the space. The instant settlement you get from Sen.
Sen is great.
That is what makes stablecoins work. That's essential. So just adding bank, like, fiat access to crypto businesses. Like, I don't know if you remember, but 2014 through 2017 was the bad old days where whether you got bank access or not determined whether you had a business or not. And that's meant to be an afterthought for startups. That's meant to be something you don't worry about. Like, okay, that's not the reason why we're going to succeed or fail. But it was.
It's quite the chicken and the egg. How do you get a bank account without getting funding?
So that's unfortunately the challenge that entrepreneurs are going to face now, is you're going to have to raise more and get more legit members of your cap table kind of thing so that you can get through that process, unfortunately. I mean, there's a famous example of Circle versus Coinbase back in the day. I think it was 2015 or 16. Circle had a buy Bitcoin product, kind of like Coinbase. They had to turn that off because they lost their bank access.
I didn't know that.
Coinbase was able to stay in business because their venture backers were able to persuade SVB to keep them banked. So that was what made the difference.
How big of a product was that for Circle?
A lot of people bought their first Bitcoin with Circle. Yeah, believe it or not.
Was that Poloniex days? Or?
Long before the acquisition.
Damn.
Long before. And so then Circle basically pivoted out of being an exchange, and they pivoted into being like a mobile money provider. And then eventually they settled on the stablecoin, which was a huge winner. But
Jeremy has quite the glow-up story. I mean, Circle was in pretty dire straits a couple of years ago.
I remember going to the office in Boston after they'd done the down round, and it was just cleaned out. And the fact that they turned it around from there is incredible. It's so rare to see a startup do a big down round and survive and turn the whole thing around. So incredibly rare.
He's solid. Yeah. So with Choke Point, with the regulatory side, the next thing is I guess, on this topic is what we can do as an industry to make ourselves more amenable to regulators, right? And you've been a long advocate of proof of reserves for a long time, right? Having centralized exchanges, showing their assets on chain. I think it's a fantastic idea. I think people have like lazily targeted you in, hey, Nick, like this doesn't show all the liabilities that are off chain attached to that. Walk us through proof of reserves and your response to that under the guise of choke point in a way of let's advance crypto. Let's make it more legit for regulators.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's interesting. Custodia, which was Caitlin Long's startup that was denied their application for a Fed Master account, they were meant to be an over-collateralized, over more than 100% reserved bank, which is not common, right? Most banks have a liquidity and a capital buffer, but it's small.
Those are single-digit percents, or
depends on the nature of the bank. But yeah, so they were meant to be an over-reserved institution. Of course, exchanges now face the challenge of post FTX and Gox and Quadriga of showing that they are fully reserved as well. And it's interesting. I see such a backlash against proof of reserves, both in the industry and outside of it. It's really often dismissed. Like Elizabeth Warren wrote a letter just trashing it, being like, this is a sham audit. It doesn't show anything. It's worse than nothing because it, tricks people into thinking that you're legit and things like that.
Who is that on? She...
Elizabeth Warren wrote it.
About what?
About the auditors that were helping with proofs of reserve. So, I mean, it's a very simple thing. It's, it doesn't omit liabilities, in my view. The notion of proof of reserve includes both sides of the balance sheet. So the asset side for an exchange is easy. You just, demonstrate that you have the assets on chain. The liability side is trickier, but doable. You're basically proving to your clients that they're included in a list of liabilities that you've disclosed publicly. It's that simple. Some exchanges do tricky stuff with Merkle trees. Some exchanges just release a list of all the liabilities and they anonymize it in certain ways. There's zero knowledge proof ways to do it now. The tech has come a long way. There's a bunch, like Binance's new proof of reserve implementation includes zero knowledge proof elements. There's a whole bunch of exchanges that you'll see in the coming months using ZK proofs of liability. So it's all like technologically getting there. It's all very doable. Any exchange can do it. And the assurances you get are very high, in my opinion. A lot of people are critics of it, but I don't see a lot of downside to doing a proof of reserve. A well-run proof of reserve, there's not a lot of downside. And if exchanges were to collectively do that, obviously, it would eliminate any exchange's ability to like do an FTX. They could still get hacked. That obviously could still occur. But you'd be then creating a standard of trust that's far greater than what exists in the legacy financial system, not just matching it, but exceeding it. I can't go to my bank and see literally the dollars that are purportedly in their vaults. Of course, they don't actually have the dollars. I can't actually evaluate for myself their liquidity ratio or their capital buffer. I just have to rely on some disclosures, on some bank regulator. And frankly, as a depositor, I'm not even aware of any of that. That's with proof of reserve, you as a user, you can literally go and see on chain, here's the assets and here's my pro rata share of them. And okay, in the liability set, here's my account and here's their confirmation that I was included in this list of liabilities. That's a level of assurance that's far better than the legacy model, and it doesn't require this infrastructure of auditors and regulators, this top-down trust-generating infrastructure, because the trust signals are being created by the industry itself, by the exchanges.
Oh, that's huge.
So you don't need as much regulation or oversight. That's a better system, right?
And I mean, that's assuming that the auditors for the centralized entities are actually doing their job.
Yeah, and they're not infallible, as we know for sure. And so that's kind of the point I really want to communicate is you can have decentralized trust provision happening at the individual entity level that gets you a level of assurance that's greater than the default model, which is top-down trust generation through auditors, consulting firms, and through the government itself.
It's kind of funny you bring up like opening the design space for auditing projects, right? like, I mean, who doesn't watch all the serial killer documentaries that Netflix puts out every week? And on every episode,
I've never watched one.
Oh, man, I'll send you some examples. All right, you don't ever watch too many. But it's funny because, like, it's always about, you know, small town cop not doing their job, and then like these groups of online people get to the bottom of the case in like 2 weeks.
Oh, really?
Right. But the whole idea is very simple. It's like opening up the number of people who can look at the data and analyze it and look for issues. Right. So when you propose something that's like, look, it's not a cure-all, but by having the proof of reserves online, everybody can audit the chain and look for issues. Whereas in the traditional world, you don't have any semblance of this at all.
So that's a great point.
It's really weird for you to say that people in the government don't agree with it, because it's automating the auditor's job for free around the world.
That's a great example. I mean, and look at the FTX situation. When did we first learn that something was really awry? It was in that week after CoinDesk wrote their expose. People went and looked at the FTX cold wallets, and they realized, huh, there's like not a lot of coins sitting in these, and they're just immediately being shuffled out to Alameda, and they're moving around way more than they should. Like, you remember those few days, right? That was the sort of like totally community-driven analysis that started to create the data points that caused people to realize FTX is not solvent. We obviously wouldn't have been able to do that in like this setting of a bank, because we wouldn't have been able to look at their wallets in real time. So when you do a proof of reserve, you're opening the kimono, right? You're releasing your list of your wallet addresses. People can go and look at the flows. So can an exchange cheat a proof of reserve? Yes. Is it very detectable because they're using a public blockchain? Yes. Can they borrow funds on a short-term basis to pass proof of reserve? Yes. Can anyone on the internet go and look and find out what they're doing? Yes.
There was something weird going on with crypto.com or something a couple weeks ago, right? When they were maybe around FTX and they were like sending money back and forth to pass.
Yeah, there was a big semi-scandal between crypto.com and Gate. I contend that it wouldn't have helped them like pass their proof of reserve, because the transaction in was not contemporaneous with the period in which they did the proof of reserve.
Got it.
But it's all very obscure, and frankly, the whole situation was weird.
It was weird.
So like something was going on. I don't think they would have succeeded in cheating the POR based on the timing. But I mean, my point is, anybody can see that if you're doing it. So it wouldn't be wise as an exchange to cheat in that manner. And also, the modern PORs that we're doing are happening on a daily basis, so like a high frequency. And for that, you wouldn't be able to borrow funds and cheat.
No, you definitely wouldn't. Also, the amounts of money at play are so large that to pass the test and to have daily audits, I mean, how many?
Yeah, where are you going to borrow billions and billions of dollars from secretly?
And then return it.
Yeah.
And what are you paying for? Why would anybody take that risk
to lend it to you? Yeah, because you're lending to someone that's trying to cheat a proof of reserve, so they're probably not very creditworthy at that point.
How many people can you call up and say, send me $10 billion, I'll send it back?
And like, I'll send it back. It's so that I can cheat this audit, in case you're wondering.
Look, you're committing fraud and you're risking your money. Don't worry, I'll send it back.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's... So, I mean, we had a lot of... When people say now, like, there's more to come, right? Like, there's more issues, there's more bodies that will get dragged to the surface. I kind of laugh at that, because I'm like, there's already been so much.
Yeah. Like, the worst possible set of things that could happen basically happened.
What are your thoughts on Tether?
So, yeah, I guess the two big, like, gray swans are Tether and Binance.
Binance, I'm kind of in your camp on the regulatory side, and I don't really think they're too malicious.
So honestly, I'm a Tether truther. So the Tether truthers think they don't have reserves, and I'm a Tether truther and that I think they have the reserves. Like, if you're Tether, you're printing money. They made like $700 million last year, I think.
How do you, is that on, just on the interest? On 70 billion?
Or like 3% on, you know, maybe half the portfolio, because it's not all in the highest yielding assets. They made tons of money. Your generic default non-fraud business model makes tons of money with like 10 staff. So why would you need
So they can do nothing and make $1 billion a year.
Yeah, I mean, what's 4% times at this point? It's like 70 billion.
Oh, yeah, way more than a billion.
Yeah, it's 2.1. It's ludicrous. It's a ludicrous amount. Jesus. And the overhead, I'm sure, is pretty low in terms of running that business. And by the way, here's the other thing. There's a lot of breakage. So,
I'd be closer to $3 billion. Sorry.
What's you know, like when Walmart issues gift cards and they don't get spent, there's breakage. So that's just pure, like, pure fiat return for them, like, I mean, seniorage.
Can't, like, redeem that there to their benefit, though, right? Like, they have to keep that out there.
I think probably at a certain point they can retire the gift cards that so
that's crazy.
Think about with Tether, like there's a certain percentage of Tether, might be 10%, maybe a little bit less, where those Tethers are never going to be redeemed because the keys were lost.
Oh, so for certain aspects where like we know that it's lost or locked, hey guys, we can redeem that. Okay, that makes sense.
So I mean, it's not like they can just requisition those Tethers, but like
they'll never be on the hook for redeeming them.
Exactly. So that's a kind of like a weird extra margin of profit that they have in their business.
It also makes it weird on the shady side, though. Like if they're already doing that to cover something up.
But I mean, look, my point is they have a fantastic business model. I mean, I'm sure being an executive at Tether is not fun because you're probably just being harassed by like various regulators all the time.
Paulo runs the whole company.
He seems chipper enough, like, too. He's kind of always in a good mood.
A lot of energy.
It's remarkable given the pressures he's under. I don't see the need to commit the fraud. Also, there's plenty of places to park those treasuries. I know people are like, oh, we don't know who like manages the portfolio. Or like, I've never met anyone that's seen Tether flow. We know now that it, you know, we know that there's investment banks in the U.S. that manage it. We know that those are in banks in Switzerland. Like, we know enough about it to know that these things exist and that there's various service providers that manage it.
What do you think the reason is for them being vague? Like, do you think it's, and I'm not sure what I even mean by vague, but is it like a security concern on like, we don't want to tell you guys where all the money is? Or why do you think there's a certain level of vagueness? Because people look at Circle and they say, that's gold, 100%, I trust that. People look at Tether and I think people are 50-50.
Well, Tether's business is being opaque, right? It's like the business of Swiss banking is to be opaque and not to unnecessarily dox their customers if they can prevent it. So that's the point. Circle will tell you the CUSIPs of all the treasuries that they hold, which is great. I'm really glad they do that. It's a totally different kind of business. Tether's business is giving offshore euro dollars to people that don't actually want to touch the U.S. banking system. That's their business. So the so in pursuit of that, of course they want to be as vague as possible because they don't want their service providers and custodians to go under full assault from the might of the U.S. regulatory establishment. So people think like, oh, why is Tether would be so much better off if they were just totally transparent? No, they'd be worse off because they'd be inviting that pressure onto everyone that they rely on, and then they'd probably be unbanked and, you know, whoever it is that is holding the treasuries for them, they would be attacked in some way. And so the Tether holders are holding Tether because they know that Tether is going to put up this kind of resistance.
So Tether's, it sounds like a bit outside the reach of Operation Choke Point.
For now, there's probably things they could do like to screw with them.
Yeah.
As we said, no one is like ever truly outside the reach of the U.S. establishment. But yeah. They exist because of Operation Choke Point, the first one.
So you brought up Reeves, like the start of when we started talking or, you know, a bit ago. And one of the things you said was that they're not, it doesn't violate this framework because they're not interest bearing or there's no reward or something like that. Circle and Tether obviously don't share their income with token holders. And people like, I guess me, I always wondered why. But to your point, if they did, that would put them under more regulatory scrutiny.
Then they would be securities.
Okay.
But they want to. That's the thing. They realize that people are redeeming stablecoins, more so Circle. Tether is like, the people that hold Tether don't want to redeem it because they can't. You know, like, they don't have a way to get dollars in many cases. So what are you going to turn the Tether in and get what in exchange? Like fruit?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like... So it's more that the USDCs, if you look at the supply, as rates rise, the USDCs get redeemed because you're getting better rates in TradFi land and inflation's still pretty high. So you have like a 7% negative carry on your cash now, why don't you bring that down to only a 3% negative, you know, with your 4% rate from treasuries? So the stablecoin issuers would love to find a way to pay interest to the holders of the stablecoins. They legally don't have a way to do that right now.
Got it. Yeah, no, I moved some money into treasuries a couple of months ago, and what a mistake. I mean, when there's that much money flowing out of crypto, it's usually pretty bullish. I mean, obviously, it's all about flows, but when rates get that high and risk assets get vacuumed out as people go to that safety, it's usually a good time to enter.
Yeah, there's a, you know, there's a big puzzle in economics, which is like, why do people hold cash if cash yields zero, right? And it's because there's a quote-unquote convenience yield. So the question is, why would anyone hold a stable in crypto when they're getting a negative 8% yield on that thanks to inflation? It's because of the opportunities that you're afforded by having that liquidity on chain. And I mean, to me, it's remarkable that anybody held a stable coin with rates going that high and with inflation being that high. But it's because crypto is still this place for wealth generation, and people might be willing to tolerate 6 months of 8% inflation and no interest whatsoever because they know that there'll be opportunities for them.
It's pretty hard to get treasury yield on stables. I mean, like Ondo Finance popped up, but it's honestly pretty complicated. You have to be a qualified investor. You have to accept KYC. Meow's up there, but like it's still pretty, I'd say kind of impossible to get treasury yield on stables.
There's a few ways to do it, I think, but they involve getting approval and like bank charters and things like that. And the Fed's made it very clear they don't want anyone to do that.
I mean, the other thing is like have somebody else pay the yield for you. Like I still don't know how Coinbase pays 1.5% to USDC holders, but.
Yeah, the other way is to do it through like an explicit fund and like one of the Reg D, you know, exemptions, things like that.
Yeah.
So like a registered product. But it is interesting that this is something that people clearly want. They want to bring TradFi yields on chain. And because of regulatory barriers, it's basically impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a great example of the government holding back an obvious type of product innovation that should exist and make everyone's lives better.
No, it definitely should exist. So macro is a bit outside of Operation Choke Point, but I think it's worth not getting too deep on macro, but I wanted to ask you, because there's 9,000 charts that macro people debate that I can't keep up with. But there's a question I want to ask you in that we're, you know, call it almost a year into a crypto bear market. Equities haven't sold off commensurate with the down move in crypto. I don't know what equities are down 20% or something on the S&P. You're like at 4,000. But it seems to me like some people are saying that, hey, we have choke point. Hey, we have a tough macro environment, et cetera, et cetera. That will take crypto lower because it's risk on. My take has always been that crypto already sold off ahead of all that. Like we're a more efficient market.
Yeah.
Do you have a view on that versus macro?
Yeah, I'm not going to sit here and say the bottom's in, but I should.
You're here for predictions.
Very specific targets. I view crypto as the market that moves first. Like during COVID, crypto sold off before anything, from what I recall.
Yeah.
My memory might be fuzzy now.
Is that 80 ETH? 90 ETH days? Or was that the last bear market before that?
Yeah, $89 ETH, right? Yeah. That was in 2020, right?
I think so, yeah.
So I see crypto as the market where things price in information. It gets priced in the fastest, as far as I can tell. I also see this is a little more difficult because, you know, crypto is not a homogenous asset class. There's all sorts of different types of things. Let's just take Bitcoin. I see it as a more gold-like analog, a zero-yielding product. So like maybe like the inverse of real rates trade, similar to gold. Doesn't trade identically with gold, but gold's been very strong lately as well, reflecting, I think, a lot of the risk in the sovereign debt, you know, state of affairs. And so I think Bitcoin and, you know, to a larger extent, crypto is reflective of that. These expectations that maybe the Zoltan Pozsar theory is coming to bear, or that the U.S. government is going to be looking at a solvency crisis and we might have a reliquification in the midst of a high inflation period, which is what the Fed wants to avoid. And that would be kind of the U.S. becoming like Argentinified. So that'd be kind of a new type of problem for the U.S. and I think very inflationary potentially. So the sovereign picture, I'm not an expert on that at all, but it looks to me like there is going to be a choice and all of the options are going to be unpalatable because we're not going to go for austerity. So it looks like we will go for inflationary policies at a time when inflation is not fully subdued.
Is the kindergarten, like, or my kindergarten macro guys are going to hang me view that we either have the Fed pivot risk on or risk assets rally, or the government has to mega print and there's mass amounts of dollars chasing crypto, bidding up asset prices. Like, when I viewed under that lens, I don't know what's why either would be bearish crypto.
The Fed pivot, I think, doesn't necessarily save risk assets. Like, if you look at other times when the Fed
markets always
started cutting rates,
yeah,
the Fed, I think, was cutting rates even before Lehman collapsed, for instance. So it doesn't necessarily, like, if the market is truly, if we're in an earnings recession, if multiples are contracting and people just want to liquidate for whatever reason, I don't think cutting rates can save the market, so to speak.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think this is the, you know, the great decoupling everybody looks for. Like, I think risk assets could keep selling off and I think crypto could keep doing well. Also because it's a novel and small asset class. Like, it's small enough that float, like, marginal flows really matter. There's no rule that says we have to trade in lockstep with equities.
So looking into like an uncertain macro and regulatory future, you are still pretty bullish crypto here because of how much we've already sold off.
Yeah. And I think now if you look at the types of buyers that exist in crypto, a lot of them exited entirely, but they have that experience and knowledge and history of being involved. And so those are very capable marginal buyers. If we do look at a sovereign default situation, or at least a sovereign debt crisis, I think that vindicates these alternative monetary systems.
Oh yeah,
I feel like that's kind of like the fundamental in all of this. And if we see, like, for instance, a wave of crypto dollarization happening globally as some of these emerging market currencies go to zero, that's also very positive crypto. So now we're at this weird stage where it's not just linear growth. It was a lot of growth. We reached a lot of people and we pulled back. A lot of those people exited the market. Now I think we're going to give them a reason to re-enter the market, basically.
That is a good point. You have a lot of smart people who were involved who can buy. Other people that left are flushed out and gone. They're not holding anymore.
Yeah, I mean, some people are fully disillusioned. So I guess it's sort of on us to create experiences and products that make it worthwhile.
Yeah.
But I see those being built.
No, I'm, you know, I'm with you. It's kind of wild. I'm like trying to keep the center of gravity around Operation Choke Point. And it is kind of wild that you had all these systemic issues that wiped people out, to your point. Like, people are gone. Some of them are super knowledgeable on crypto. But, you know, changing the topic back, when you go to a regulator and you say, you know, look, guys, we don't need any taxpayer dollars to keep our industry insanely efficient. Like, we don't need Lehman bailouts, like Merrill bailouts, like, we're clean. We're good. Like, do you think that is understood by Emmer and others?
Well, certainly the members of Congress that I talked to get that. Certain members of, you know, folks in Washington don't. Actually, Chris Waller, who's on the Fed Board of Governors, said at a conference recently something to the extent of, you know, crypto is like baseball cards. I don't hold it, and but I don't begrudge the people that do. But here's the thing, don't, you know, go losing a lot of money in crypto and then complain and ask for a taxpayer-funded bailout when you do. I'm like, no one has ever done that.
No one ever has.
No one has asked for a bailout when some token went to zero.
No.
Like, we understand that this is a pretty private sector thing. There is no bailout at the end of the day. So I don't know where he like got that idea from, that people are asking for it. But yeah, I mean, this is an industry that has had its fragilities and systemic problems. But at the end of the day, we had our credit crisis that was flushed out. Now there's new forms of credit emerging, more accountable, better ones, in my opinion. The exchanges are reforming themselves and focusing on trust generation with things like proof of reserve. So, you know, and we're still kicking. So, you know, we dealt with the horrors of 2022. and we're emerging in a new, better form now with no bailouts.
So I don't know the right word for this. You probably know it. You're way more well-read than I am. But it seems like whether you get a bailout, like, so if you're thinking about Wall Street or if you're thinking about Web 2, people are generally okay to give away their privacy in Web 2. You know, who cares? Like, I'll get my $5 Equifax check in the mail. Or have the banks be bailed out on Wall Street. The government will do it. Who cares? It seems like that's okay. And although crypto solves that in the sense that you'll never have a taxpayer bailout and you can protect your identity on Web3, it doesn't seem like people will care because it's always just been solved already by the government, right? So how do you get that feedback loop back and explain to people why that's important, right? Because if I'm on Wall Street and I'm a bank and it blows up, like, who cares? The government will bail it out. But
yeah,
it's, well, hard to mentally get there.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to preach self-sovereignty. I think you have to provide people with experiences that are better than the less self-sovereign alternatives. So on social, for instance, like, why would people be attracted to Web3 social? Because they get abused on Web2 social in terms of they're getting arbitrarily deplatformed, banned. They're basically, my view is, their digital property rights are being constantly violated. They don't have digital property rights. So you have to convey to them, if you're, you know, self-custodying your identity information, your keys, you're engaging in Web3 social, you have those property rights for the first time, which you never had in Web2 or Web1. Same with financial assets. When you're dealing with a banking system, you can't really withdraw your assets and, you know, frictionlessly move to another provider. There's no real interoperability in the financial system, certainly not on a cross-border basis. Now you get a chance to utilize, you know, DeFi to frictionlessly move from one exchange to the next to take your assets into self-custody. That's just a fundamentally more sovereign experience. So I think it's about explaining to people that there are better experiences that we can better equip you to make money, to tend to your digital homestead with these tools. It's not just about preaching the ideology, the philosophy to them. I think it's about product experiences.
The Web3 side is interesting. Do you think people would adopt crypto because, or more likely to adopt Web3 alternatives because they're not earning anything using Facebook or Twitter to the benefit of the companies who are, or because they have control over their data?
I think it's about control. It's basically like, you think of it as you're settling, you know, like you're settling 40 acres of land out there in the American West. If, you know, constantly the sheriff is coming in and stealing your cattle or whatever, and there's literally nothing you can do about it, you're going to be looking for alternatives. If you lay out your homestead and you stipulate, this is my land, and it's absolutely sacrosanct, and no one can come in there and like mess with your farm, you're going to feel much more secure. And I think that's really the difference, is these are digital, this is digital real estate where you can actually build up your own reputation. You can communicate freely with people. You can run your business on there. And if you are doing it the right way with Web3, and of course, it doesn't all exist yet, you know, that can be secure. And, you know, you're not beholden to some Silicon Valley technocrat and his weird rules and arbitrariness and the Trust and Safety Committee and all that stuff. That is what I think intuitively appeals to people. People haven't really described this very well. Like, we're all using these internet Web 2 platforms, but we're all serfs on the plantation. It's like a feudal situation. We have no power whatsoever. And a handful of people in Silicon Valley have all the power. This hasn't really been communicated well, I think, to the general public. But that's the essence of it, in my view. It's about property rights.
It's hard. I know we're getting off track, but it's interesting. And I have you in person, so let's go down this track. I mean, it seems harder for me to understand the inflection point on Web3 social than it is. It's way easier for me to understand on money, right? But Web3 social is hard. Like, you have Elon, he took over Twitter, exposed how embedded the government was, exposed how bad the algo was, how many extra people they had, et cetera, et cetera. And you still don't have Web3 alternatives like winning yet. I mean, there's a lot of technical reasons as to why, but the switch from Web2 to Web3 social seems obviously a lot harder for me to conceptualize.
I think it's because the networks that Twitter and Facebook have are just so large and robust, and the switching costs are so enormously high. You know, starting from scratch on Farcaster or Noster or Mastodon, a non-crypto one, like that is difficult. You're literally starting from scratch, right?
You can't even get the crypto people to use it often.
Yeah, so you have 100,000 followers on Twitter. You're starting at zero. That sucks.
Yeah.
So that first move off of Big Web 2 centralized social is going to be really difficult and frictional. But people will do it if they get fed up enough.
Yeah,
so I think it'll be like really slow and then fast. Because once you're active in like Web 3 social and now you have access to a bunch of different interfaces, different applications that can all plug into the same underlying data. The social graph is shared. So the, you know, actual applications are really thin and there's like a thicker protocol underneath. That's far better, right? I mean, that's just a structurally better way to do business. You can opt into different censorship regimes or moderation regimes, right? So once that kicks off, it's very powerful, very sticky, and I think ends up dominating. But for now, we're stuck in this world where the established platforms are still so enormously big. I mean, they've captured most of the world's population, like WhatsApp, Facebook, Instagram, whatever. Like, that's so hard to switch out of. But once you have like a little feedback loop going in the Web3 world, I think that just dominates.
There's also, it's really well said, there's also other things, like pretty basic things, right? Like, just the ability to roll your own UI, like based on the feed, like yeah. Little things like that are pretty exciting.
And so, of course, the configurable model will win in the end. It's like if there was one way to create a website and everybody had to do that. Ugh. Like, obviously, like whatever, the WordPress or the Wix, like obviously that would eventually win. Can you imagine if there was just one website template and that was it?
Oh my God, man.
Wix, so
the internet would be so boring.
Yeah. So like clearly it's not going to endure.
So to close out the convo, I wanted to circle back to Civ 3, your fund. So just to preface, we have Choke Point. You know the way, you have a really good tune of the way the world is going on the regulatory side. You have a really good view on where we're going macro side. And you also have your own ideologies about what you want to see in crypto. Figuring or marrying those three with what you want to invest in is really hard because you're also like, akin to the deals that you see and you're able to attract, and then having to mix them with those tenants is really hard. So how do you, I guess on one hand, what is your thesis on the deals that you want to do through Civ 3? And how do you match it with the fact that, you know, hey, the government's going after crypto, macro's kind of rough, and we're 5 to 10 years away from being scot-free here?
Yeah, great question. I mean, we invest on a 10-year horizon. I mean, standard venture fund. So we kind of have the luxury of being able to look ahead of the kind of short, medium-term challenges. And frankly, I think that's better for deployment. If it means that only the most high-conviction entrepreneurs are building, those are kind of the ones you want to back, the ones that start businesses into a headwind. If we're in the middle of a bear market, reminds me of when we started our first fund. That was a great time to deploy. I feel similarly now. So on the timing basis, we're pretty much business as usual. Even if things look bleak in the near term, that doesn't really change the business model too much. So I feel lucky that we're operating out of the standard venture structure. In terms of who I want to attract, you know, I used to think, you know, you had to be really strongly thesis driven, like write your Medium posts about your theses like every quarter or whatever. And
50 tweet storm on it.
Yeah. And then, you know, request for startup. And then someone would just like come along and like do the startup. And then you'd write them a check and it'd be great. And I'm just realizing now, I'm about 5 years into Civ, almost to the month. And, you know, some of the best startups we've encountered have been ones where I could, like, could have never even conceived of the idea before. So I really am now of the school of thought that sort of I let the founders do the thinking and all the smart stuff, and I'm just basically the cheerleader. And, you know, if the idea works, it works and it'll make sense to us. But we don't try and prescribe anymore. Of course, we have things that we think we're good at, and like there's certainly network effects in the portfolio now. So, you know, crypto financial infrastructure, exchanges, brokerages, custodians, lenders. Certain themes that I really like right now are certainly crypto dollarization. I've always liked it, but I see it intensifying. So fintechs that are using stables underneath, especially in emerging markets and places where there's a real demand for this stuff, property rights for the US bank system, overseas. That's really interesting to me. Startups are taking advantage of newer trust generation methodologies, like proof of reserve, but being expanded to new places. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing lenders building that in. So it's not just about exchanges doing proof of reserve. It's new models for lending, in a more credible way, where you're proving your balance sheet to other firms. Under-collateralized DeFi lending took some hits, but I think that will be the future. It'll be a hybrid DeFi-CeFi approach to lending. DeFi, you know, a lot of headwinds there, especially in a regulatory sense, but I think it really acquitted itself well throughout the crisis. And then places where we're seeing actual utility and uptake for people that aren't the usual crypto consumer crowd, especially in the NFT space, I'm seeing a lot of usage of basically, when people say fidgetals, I don't like the term, but I'm seeing NFTs being paired with physical products, physical collectibles. There's a lot to do there. And that's happening regardless of all the trends in crypto up and down. That's just happening anyway, because it's just fundamentally more useful to have, digitally embodied physical products that have a digital marker to them, which is typically an NFT form. So those are places that I'm looking right now. But again, I'm pretty open-minded.
No, this is cool. I have a bunch of questions. I mean, I agree with you. Our funds are not 5 years old yet, but I think I agree with you in the fact that whenever I've been pushed to write a thesis, I've always felt like it was fluffy or self-serving in the sense that, like, you're going to spend a whole week on this. Like, just go review a week's more projects and find something you're really interested in.
Exactly. Yeah. The theses I write now is because I'm compelled to for some reason. The other thing I'm excited about is actually the emergence of an NFT market on Bitcoin. So the Ordinals, I think, is really interesting. I think it could be seen eventually as like a premium block space because Bitcoin has pretty good data availability guarantees.
It does help with the fee story.
And the fees. Yeah. I mean, that's the second order effect. But I'm actually seeing folks that have never used Bitcoin in their lives now syncing a full node and like that's learning cool. how to use it. So
nice. The other thing kind of made me laugh internally was you said a 10-year horizon, and I'm thinking back to last bull market when these deals were 24-hour closes.
Yeah.
And I always laughed because I'm like, we're going to be in business together for like 3 to 10 years, and you want me to get to know you in
it's crazy.
A 45-minute call?
And it's also, as a founder, you shouldn't want that because you're going to have to deal with these people on your cap table for the next X many years. And you should want to, like, it goes both ways. You should want them to be good people that you trust, that you can work with, especially if they're on your board.
Yeah, that's oof.
So that kind of approach to life, it never worked for me.
No, me either. I think the founder should do way more diligence for sure. I mean, ask around because...
Yeah, you know, do like due diligence on the VCs, like do reference calls on them.
The founder should pick the projects too. I mean, don't let your person you're reference checking, you know, pick, right?
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, you're right. If you as a founder expect to be in business, you know, as opposed to just like launching a token, then, you know, quiet quitting or whatever, like, yeah, the cap table matters. You can't fire someone on your cap table you don't like.
No, you can't. So you said you're coming up on your fifth year of Civ. You mentioned a couple sector areas you like. I'm going to pick one out of the hat because it's just easiest for me to relate to here is DeFi. There's a lot of DeFi projects that are already launched, right? Like that are massive. Liquidity, user bases, brand, Uniswap, Compound, Aave, etc. When you're looking at a new deal, it's got to be hard because when you started Civ, it was... You know, I think the only thing that you had back then was like the MakerDAO interest rate calls. Like there was no real DeFi. Like, so you're looking at new deals, but there's also like a massive amount of already de-risked liquid projects that are your comps. How do you like compare your VC deal flow to what's active and live in the market as a comp?
Well, we have the luxury of being able to do either. So if the privates seem less interesting on a valuation basis and the publics are in beaten down valuations, then, you know, you toggle your attention accordingly. I think right now, actually, the publics, there's a lot to be said for them. Already liquid tokens where maybe there's been already some vesting, you know, they've been in market for a year or two. I think we're blessed now with having really decent metrics and analytics such that we can actually evaluate these things systematically, on-chain cash flows and things like that. I don't see a lot of specialists in that. I think it's a pretty wide open space. And frankly, like the data could be better around that.
Yeah, no, it can be. Request for startup.
Yeah, so I am pretty fascinated by the fact that you have real-time financials for what are, you know, early stage businesses, basically. That's a wealth of information. I don't think it's being taken advantage of. So,
it's pretty similar to your proof of reserves thesis, right?
Yeah.
Having a MakerDAO balance sheet is hard to argue with.
Yeah. And that's another thing that I think we should be making this point to regulators over and over is like this stuff is all on chain. It's transparent. You can assess the risk in the system to your heart's content.
It's kind of funny. When I did equity research, you'd be scrambling to compile data that is already, you know, 1-2 months old, right? And it's,
yeah,
you know, you're just, it's old data still.
Yeah. So the other thing is, I think there's structural reasons why the publics are a little underloved right now. A lot of funds just structurally have a hard time allocating to that, or they prefer privates. So I think it's the valuations actually just reflect the capital availability and the flows. Also, the custody rule that the SEC is now talking about will make life more difficult for some of the larger funds to access some of these more exotic assets.
RIAs and such.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I guess Civ is 5 years old, third fund, a lot of portcos, a lot of analysts, a lot of conversations. What do you think's like the biggest learning or learnings that you've had running the fund for this long? I mean, there's got to be a bunch of, usually it's like a massive headache that turns out to be a solution and a win. But what was it?
Yeah, so many things, so many lessons. Number one by far is just don't be too rigid ideologically. Don't get painted into a corner.
That's a good one.
You know,
you've demonstrated that too.
Well, have your convictions, but be flexible and don't let people pigeonhole you. And that totally happened to me. And it was very difficult to ultimately take the leap to be like, look, I'm a Bitcoiner, but I'm not a maximalist. I'm not a fundamentalist. Even though people probably should have known, you know, from day one, you just had to look at my public portfolios on there, right on the website. But the discrepancy between the public perception and the reality became so large that reconciling it was incredibly difficult when it came down to it.
How long did it take?
To come to that realization gap. Or...
No, not the realization. Well, maybe, but bridging the gap too, I think, publicly.
Well, I mean, there were some catalytic events in the summer of last year, and I think I'm probably out the other side now, so maybe 8 months.
How long did it take to realize it?
Well, it was clear from the start that there was a tension.
Yeah.
So I don't regret ever having been a public Bitcoiner or anything like that, but...
I don't know how you get a level of depth without even being a daily or a weekly maximalist on something.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way that you can wake up every morning and be interested, like, yeah, and, you know, really get deep into a project is to care about it. So,
you can't be like an armchair academic. Like, you got to be involved, right?
Yeah. So I think if you really want to be like a voice when it pertains to a protocol or a project, like, you're going to get close to it. And this, you know, that's just the fact. But yeah, I guess I could have been more deliberate about that. Aside from that, I'm really happy. I don't have too many regrets. Like, of course, this lose sleep sometimes over deals that we didn't do that were unicorns. But honestly, I'm grateful to still be in business. I saw a lot of my friends and colleagues and fellow funds in the industry just explode over the last year. And I'm glad that we set ourselves up in such a way that we're still fine and have dry powder and able to stomach the gyrations and keep moving, because it's basically about survival.
It really is. A lot of people blew up this year. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It gives you a lot of perspective.
It really does. We're going to have a new class of crypto soon.
Yeah. I mean, I'm seeing a lot of churn. I'm seeing a lot of new funds raised. So there'll be new perspectives, new folks in the market, which is great.
I'm seeing a lot of micro funds raised.
Yeah.
Like a lot of small 25 ones. Mil. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like 1-2 founders kind of thing.
I think it's great. I mean, you know, a lot of GPs from that started 10 years ago are just checked out and, you know, not as excited as they were.
I mean, so. It's just, I like the microfund approach because you have people that are like specialists in their field.
Yeah.
Like they're really dedicated. They're really passionate about what they're doing. And on the flip side of having $5, $10 billion AUM funds, they're kind of just competing on allocating capital and their money managers, right? Like
yeah.
they don't really care about a 5X. They just care about the AUM fees.
Yeah. It's asset accumulators versus people that really want to bet on themselves. So like as an LP, you're getting so much more work per unit of AUM than the mega funds where it's just like quiet quitting VCs that are playing a lot of pickleball. I know I joke. I don't play that much pickleball.
I play a lot.
We've never played. We've been trying. This is how hard we work. We've been trying to schedule it for weeks, and it's never happening.
I don't want
to
lose publicly.
I won't tell anyone. It'll be a secret.
That's fair. Do you ever see yourself running? I mean, you said like keep your opinions like open to change. Like, do you think you'd ever see an avenue where you'd want to run, or want if Civ crushes it in such a way that you're running 5 or 10 billion, is that something that you would continue to do or something you'd look to close down?
I can't imagine a world where we get that big. 250 is probably the biggest fund we'll ever raise. I think there's merit to, because like I don't see ventures that scalable. If you're a seed or a series A focus fund and there's only so much capital per GP that you can have, I think it's 20 to 50 million, you know, per GP.
I think if you go over 500 million in fund size, you literally have to back a new L1.
It's perverse. And like there's capital constraints to the strategy. There's some strategies that just work below a certain threshold and not above it. And, you know, I think LPs are rightfully concerned about the inflows into crypto. Those trends have reversed now. But yeah, I think our strategy works well at our size and not much larger.
It's also like just the quality of life, sleep aspect, like running so much money, doing so many deals, like it's just a headache and attention. Whereas you could run something way more cleaner and smaller.
Yeah. And you also want to give the attention to your portfolio companies, especially if you're sitting on boards that they deserve. There's only so many boards you can sit on. Like
yeah.
there are scalability questions there. And as I said, venture, it's like a human driven business. So what are you selling? You're selling the GP's attention at the end of the day. And there's only so many GPs.
Have you ever had a strong, you don't have to give me names, but of the board, but have you ever had a strong dissenting opinion on a board that ended up going positively, or are these boards generally chiller?
I would say nothing where it went to the vote and a formal vote and the board was actually split on that. Normally okay. We try and reconcile problems before yeah. that.
I mean, you've seen like, I mean, the one I usually reference is not a venture story, but it's the GE book, like Lights Out. And the crazy part was the CEO like controlled the board and the CEO role, which is obviously a huge joke. It's the reason why you have the board is separated. And I mean, the shit that they did over riding a $650 billion company to down a 60 or whatever it was at was outrageous.
Yeah. I mean, we're learning those lessons in corporate governance over and over again. In
crypto's recreating corporate governance.
Yeah. We're just learning it from scratch.
Yeah.
It's like safety regulations are written in blood. Like corporate governance rules are written in like shareholder value destroyed, you know?
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Nick, this has been a blast. Thanks so much for coming on, man. And I'm sure we'll play pickleball and do this again soon.
Yeah, you owe me for On the Brink now.
I do. Yeah. I'm happy to come on.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Of course.